For those of you who don't know who I am, my name is David Hudson. I'm a third generation Phoenix cotton farmer. I got involved in this quest about 1975 in doing analytical work on natural products on our farm. I became very intrigued with the chemistries I was seeing because, in fact, the chemistry was not, in fact, what the analytical data was saying it was. In other words, I would send the material to a lab to have them tell me what was there, and they would tell me one thing, and then when I performed the chemistries on it and actually saw the chemistries, it was something totally different. And so, you know, my interest in whatever this material was quite profound. You have to understand, I am not a chemist. I have never studied physics. I've never studied chemistry. I'm just the guy that paid for everything. I do find that present, I am teaching some of the top physicists in the country. I'm working with Westinghouse and GE and people like this. They bring in their top physicists. And, you know, when you finally get up to a level of understanding, like when I spoke down in Santa Barbara, I was explaining superconductivity to him, and the man was sitting in the front row, just kept nodding his head, nodding his head. And after I finished, the gentleman came up and he says, "Dave, I work with Bardeen of Bardeen, Cooper, and Schreifer in his laboratories, and you know this is the Nobel laureate for the theory of superconductivity." He said, "Your explanation of superconductivity is very, very accurate, very correct, and I find it just profound that some farmer would understand it." When you do get up to the level of understanding where you are talking to people who do know their business, then they appreciate this. Otherwise, they don't. So, you know, if you do understand this, you are up in the top 1%. You know, you're very, very elevated, which says a lot for your teacher. I want you to know that in all of my work in science that I have never encountered anyone who understood it as clearly and precisely as the tapes that I listened to this afternoon of Rompa making a presentation. I can only tell you that it's very embarrassing to hear my name mentioned in the presentation and then the jokes are being made about me. You know, I think it's important for the people who don't know how I am that if the ones who've already heard this will bear with me a little bit while I go through a little bit of the background. As I begin to investigate this unknown material, basically the area that drew me very strongly into it was our work with soils. And we were actually have a problem in Arizona called a sodium problem. And we have the high sodic soils, which means the soils have a lot of sodium in it. And so we were actually buying sulfuric acid from the mines and bringing it in tanker trucks and injecting it on our soils in 6-inch ribbons in the soil at 30 tons to the acre. Now this was 93% sulfuric acid, 30 tons to the acre. In doing this, what would happen if we use irrigated agriculture, we don't get rainfall like you people here. We get about as much rainfall in a year as you get in 2 or 3 days here. And so we were actually putting it on our soil and putting the irrigation water on behind the tractors. And as this water ran across the field, it would hit this acid, and the acid would just froth and foam and bubble and suds. But what we were doing is we were making sodium sulfate, which is called a white alkali, out of sodium, which is the black alkali. And the white alkali was leachable. The water would dissolve the white alkali and wash it out of our soil. And so we're able to leach the white alkali out of the topsoil. In doing that leaching, one of the things we had to be very careful about is you have to be sure that there's enough buffer substance, something that keeps the pH stable in the soil. And so we had to find out whether there was a lot of calcium carbonate in our soil. Because if there was a lot of calcium carbonate, what would happen is you put the sulfuric acid on, it would really drop the pH, and then you couldn't produce anything. You could germinate the seed, but the plant would get about this big and just quit growing. It just had none of the trace nutrients that are associated with the crops we were raising in Arizona. And so in the investigation of what I had in my soil, I kept running up against this stuff, you know, whatever this stuff was. So finally I just committed, well, I'm going to do an investigation of this material. I'm going to find out what this stuff is. Now, keep in mind, I know nothing about chemistry, nothing at all. I mean, I just take it to commercial laboratories, they run the work. So we actually got this material, dissolved it out of the ore, and basically our ore, our soil, is a decomposed rock. It's just dirt. There's no topsoil. There's no organic material. It's just dirt. So we took the dirt, we dissolved it in acid, and we got it in solution. Then we added powdered zinc to the acid, and it precipitated out as a black. And we filtered the black out on a filter paper and got it totally dried, and we set it out in the sunlight to dry. And as it dried in the sunlight, it exploded. Now, this didn't make any sense. How could you have an explosion of a metal? It didn't make any sense at all. And so we did it again. We got it all in solution. We added powder zinc. It came out as kind of this bluish-black precipitate. We filtered it out, put it out in the sun, and as we dried it, it exploded. But we got to looking, and what had happened is our Pyrex, or our porcelain filtering funnel, was fractured and cracked from the heat. And I said, well, you know, this is really interesting because it doesn't seem like there's any explosion or an implosion. It's just tremendous release of short wavelength light. And I said, you know, whatever is going on, this is not like any explosion or explosion I've ever seen. So what we did is we actually took a brand new pencil that had not been sharpened, and we stood the pencil on its end next to the filter. We put the filter out to dry, and as it dried, it exploded. But when it did, it burnt the pencil about one-third in two, but it didn't knock the pencil over. Now, this just is not explainable. It's not explainable with any understanding of chemistry that we had. It was like there was a tremendous release of energy from this material, whatever it was, whatever the stuff was, tremendous release of light, but it was like 50,000 flash bulbs all being ignited all at the same time, just a tremendous burst of heat, but no gas. And this just didn't make any sense at all. I was perplexed. The people working with me were perplexed. I said, this just doesn't make any sense at all. I sent it to commercial laboratories. I say, what's in this stuff? Now, do you understand? I took it out of the sunlight and I dried it inside, and it doesn't explode. So I dried it inside, sent it to commercial laboratories for analysis, and they told me I had iron, silicon, aluminum. Now, this is just the mundane, lowly, ordinary elements of the earth. Just about any dirt you pick up has iron, silicon, aluminum in it. And I said, but iron, silicon, aluminum don't explode. And you can't tell me a compound you can make them into that explodes. And they said, well, that's right. And I said, then when it's totally dried, it will not redissolve in any acid. They said, gee, is that right? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, it's iron, silicon, aluminum. So, anyway, I did go back to finally to Cornell University, where there was an expert that took me months and months to locate, but a man who claimed to be an expert on metals analysis. And when I got it back to Cornell University, he put it on this tremendous, and I say tremendous, it was a huge, huge instrument. From behind glass doors, here was these eight different microscopy heads that actually did X-ray diffraction, X-ray fluorescence, tunneling microscopy. All these different types of analysis were all set up on the one sample. And he says, Dave, we can analyze down to 3 to 5 parts per billion on any material above chlorine on the periodic table. I said, well, gee, this will solve it once and for all. We'll find out really what I got here. So he put it on there, turned the machine on. He says, Dave, you've got iron, silicon, aluminum. I said, no, sir, I do not have iron, silicon, aluminum. You cannot come up with a compound of iron, silicon, aluminum that's a blue, black in color. And he looked it up in the CRC and he said, well, there's ferrofluoro cyanide and there's, you know. I said, but that doesn't have the chemical properties this has. So finally I got so frustrated. I said, well, do you have a chemistry lab around here we can go to work? I want to show you how this stuff reacts in acid. So we took it over to a chemistry lab and we played with this for like 4 or 5 hours. And I was finally able to remove all the silica, all the iron, and all the aluminum. I still had 98% of the sample left. And now he puts it on his microprobe and he says, Dave, you have pure nothing. Now, I want you people to understand this is really, really difficult to get pure nothing because in metals refinement, you can get 99.8, 99.9, 99.99, 99.999, But you cannot buy 100.00 because even the high technology metallurgists know that you always have impurity atoms. But we were fortunate enough, we were able to get rid of all the iron, all the silicon, all the aluminum, and then he says, Dave, there is no absorption or emission spectra in the sample that agrees with any standards we have here at Cornell University. And I said, wait a minute. Aren't you the man that said you could analyze down to 3 to 5 parts per billion? I don't want to know parts per billion. I have 100% something, and I want to know what that is. And he just said, Dave, I can't help you. I don't know what it is. So I came back to Arizona, and we were doing some metallurgical studies with it. We found out that when we melted it with lead, it was settled at the bottom of lead. So it had a specific gravity that was heavier than lead. And yet when we brought it into the lead and we put it on a bone ash cupel, which is what they use in metallurgy, the bone ash cupel absorbs all the lead and leaves a little bead of gold and silver. I said, well, let's put it on the cupel and cupel it down. Well, when we cupel it down, there was nothing left. So it wasn't gold and silver. But then we actually took known amounts of gold and we put it in our solution and we repeatedly evaporated that and we cupelled that down and we got no gold or silver. So we weren't able to recover even the gold we put into it. Then I took solutions containing this, whatever it was, and I put known amounts of gold in the solution and repeatedly evaporated it down over and over and over. And then I took that solution up, we extracted it with MIBK, set it into atomic absorption, and it now contains no gold or silver. And then I put gold in it. So I asked the commercial laboratory doing the AA analysis, I said, doesn't this bother you? You know, is it of concern to you that we took this amount of gold, we put it into this solution, we now have it extracted into MIBK, it's a colored solution, we feed it in the AA and it doesn't read. Doesn't that bother you? And they said, not at all. They said, we're running a procedure that was given to us when we bought this machine. It's the standard in the industry, and that's what we're being paid to report. And I said, but doesn't it bother you that it's not accurate? And they said, not at all. They said, in fact, Dave, we don't even have to allow you in our laboratory, and so would you please leave? Now, the gentleman back at Cornell University had also said, Dave, if you'll give us $350,000, we'll put some graduate students to studying it. And I decided, for $350,000, I can figure out more than you can figure out. And I don't know anything. So anyway, about 1979, I went to the Siegfried, who was a German fellow with a spectroscopy machine, in Phoenix, and he had actually worked for about 27 years in emission spectroscopy. He was the senior equipment designer with Lab Test Industries. He actually engineered and blueprinted and designed emission spectroscopic equipment, and then he went out in the field and set them up and made them work for specialty orders that came into Lab Test down in L.A. And when he retired from the company, he had designed and built a 3.5-meter machine. And this is a huge machine. For most of you who are familiar with emission spectroscopy, most machines that are in the universities are about 1.5 meters. And this one was 3.5 meters, which means the arc was huge, you know, that the light is projected on when it does the diffraction experiment. And the great thing about a 3.5-meter emission spectroscopy machine is it really separates the line spectra when it goes through the machine. And so I went to him and I told him that I would like for him to run these procedures that were in the Soviet book that I had been given by the metallurgist. And he said, well, Dave, this is all worthless information you're bringing me because, see, we Germans are the best metallurgists. And he said, I studied over in Dortmund, West Germany, and the West Germans are far ahead of the rest of the world in metallurgy. And this isn't necessary to do the kind of burn time the Soviet book says. He says, 15 seconds is the longest burn time you need to run on a sample. That's the standard in the industry. And when you understand that the temperature in the DC arc is 5,500 degrees centigrade. Now, that's basically the temperature of the sun. And he says, when you put an element on here and strike the arc, in the first 15 seconds, everything there boils away. And he says, you read it as it boils away, you actually read it in the DC arc. And that light goes to the prisms, is broken up into the spectra, and you find out which elements are there. He says, so Dave, you know, the Russian book says you burn it for 300 seconds. He says, this is preposterous. In 15 seconds, we get everything. And I said, well, this is the Soviet Academy of Sciences, the Vernadsky Institute for Precious Metal Research, a government-funded laboratory that says burn it for 300 seconds. So just do me a favor, and let's just spend my money and burn it for 300 seconds. And so he said, okay, Dave, you know. So he sent to West Germany, had all the orifices built to do the spectroscopic analysis, and you actually have to put an inert gas around the carbon electrodes so that when you strike the arc, air doesn't get the electrode and oxidize the carbon. And so he said, Dave, we'll burn it for 300 seconds, but he said, this is absolutely worthless. It's just throwing your money down the drain. And I said, well, throw my money down the drain. I have to see it. Well, when he set this machine up and did it the way the Soviet Academy of Sciences said, he struck the arc, and in the first 15 seconds, we read iron, silica, aluminum, traces of calcium, traces of titanium, and that was it. Nothing else. But you look in while that arc is still burning, and sitting there on the electrode is a glowing white ball of material. And it's still sitting there on top of the electrode. And the arc is going to be all around it, and it's just sitting there, nothing reading. And it doesn't read for 20 seconds. It doesn't read for 25 seconds. It doesn't read for 30 seconds. It doesn't read for 35 seconds. It doesn't read for 40 seconds. 45 seconds. 50 seconds. 55 seconds. 60 seconds. 65 seconds. And then at 70 seconds, exactly when the Soviet Academy of Sciences book said it would read, palladium begins to read. And then platinum. And then ruthenium. And then rhodium. And then iridium, and then osmium. They actually read in the sequence of their boiling temperatures, exactly as the Soviet Academy of Sciences said they would read. Now, you know, the guy just says, my gosh, Dave, get out of my lab. And he actually sent me away while he reproduced this work for about 3.5 weeks, all on his own. And he called him back up, and actually he didn't call, his wife called me up. And she says, Dave, Siegfried wants me to call and apologize. Now Siegfried, you know, German eagle, he couldn't call me and apologize himself. He had his wife call him. Anyway, he ran this material over and over and over, and he checked every spectral line. He wanted to be absolutely certain with this material. He checked every possible interference. And he says, Dave, it's these elements. It is these elements. Well, I came back and worked with him about 2 years after that, and we actually worked with this and worked with it until we actually had standards that exactly equaled our unknown material. Now, one of the things that really perplexed us about this material is when we buy standards of rhodium and iridium and ruthenium, we put them on the electrode, and we strike the arc, they read. And they read for the first 15 seconds, and then they stop reading. But if you look in on the electrode, there's a glowing white ball of metal. And it doesn't read from 15 seconds until 70 seconds. There's nothing reading at all. And then at 70 seconds, it begins to read again. And it reads palladium, platinum, ruthenium, rhodium, iridium, and osmium. In exactly the same ratio. In fact, 85% of the metal read in the late burn time, not in the early burn time. Only about 15% was reading in the early burn time. And so all the commercial spectroscopists in this country who are actually working with these elements are reporting to you 15% of the sample and telling you it's 100%. But it's not. There's a whole bunch more than this there. So I decided, well, look, this is all well and good, but I'm spending lots of money. I got about $70,000-$80,000 in this thing now with all the time and effort and standards and PK blenders and buffers and, you know, over and over and over running this, paying him for all this time for all these years. I said, look, let's just cut to the chase. Let's go right where all the best analysis we can get in this country. What is the very best analysis available at any price?